or philosophical in nature are those which rest solely on his own self-interest or well-being.
This is the idea that it needs to be something greater than, you know, political science. That is, it can be philosophical if it is philosophical and moral, but it can't just be, you know, a hypothetical or, you know, I think the country should spend its money on, you know, better things than going to war. I mean, that's just kind of a sociological or philosophical argument. It has to be something deeper than that. That certainly could be part of it. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay, and number four, Martha?
He, the applicant, must explain fully to the board how his conscience reacts to training in the use of guns and other weapons designed for combatant military use. He may present witnesses who are aware of his conscientious and sincere opposition to participation in war.
Okay, and that is the, you know, there's kind of a subjective element there. You have to show that you're sincere. And one of the ways you can show you're sincere is to have a fairly extensive background and be able to document that this isn't something you just made up recently, and specifically how you feel about weapons and military training. You want to go to the next one? Go to CO questions. There you go. And I've got, if any of you want a copy of this stuff. Okay, here are the three questions. What's your belief is? What's the basis of your belief for your opposition to participation in all war? Secondly, what the source of that belief was? And thirdly, your good faith or sincerity. So here's how the question actually reads on the, and then maybe we could try and see if someone, how you would think you would answer this. And you can take as long or as short as you want when you fill out this form. Here's the question. Describe the beliefs which are the basis for your claim as a conscientious objector. If appropriate, state whether these beliefs would permit you to serve in a non-combatant position in the armed forces or pay taxes for war. So you can see they make the question tougher by putting in those provisos at the end. As far as paying taxes for war, can anyone remember one of the first words we looked at down at the bottom of that first definition that would help you out?
For the particular one, or what?
Yeah, participation in a particular war. Because it's the participation in war that is the key to it. You know, not paying taxes. Paying taxes is a much more indirect form of supporting the government, who then makes some decisions, who then decides how to handle conflict, who then mobilizes troops. So, this is belief. I just randomly wrote down a couple of things that occurred to me, or that could occur to people about this topic. In other words, what the belief is. And the first couple are biblical. You know, in the Old Testament, thou shalt not kill, that's a pretty basic one. Actually, if you said to the answer to this question, I am a conscientious objector to all wars because I believe the Bible teaches us not to kill, and to go in the military would be supporting the killing of other people, period, that would actually answer the question. One danger I saw, let me tell you how these court cases go. They don't know anything about what's in your inside your head, either the local board or the judges or the prosecutors. But if you say an awful lot of things and write you know, a 10-page essay to this, they probably can find some things in that essay to start arguing with or poking holes at. And if you keep it simple, probably not as bare bones as I just said, but that actually qualifies. And one of the things you can do is when if you write out a statement of your beliefs, you can file them at your church or at your church's central offices, the national church offices, or there are other organizations like the Center for Conscientious Objection that will accept those. And so you can say, in other words, if you wrote one up today, you know, on July 2nd of 2005, I filed this. That would be very persuasive evidence that your beliefs were sincere, because it was, you know, long before you were in the horns of a dilemma of actually having an induction notice. If you choose to do that, do it after discussing it with, you know, your family, with probably your minister, and do it, and it would be a good idea to talk to a lawyer about it too. If you want to talk to me about it, you know, while I'm here, I'd be glad to go over anybody's statements. Be very careful that you don't start rattling on about things you don't really believe or go into a lot of extraneous stuff. Because if you keep it simple and you know it's true, then it's going to be harder for a local board or a prosecutor to find a little defect or loophole.
I'm sorry if you addressed this earlier. My children are young, 7 and 10. Does it do anything to speak of on behalf of them? I've been teaching this in my home and have that documented somehow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very good thing. We'll get to that when we get down to the third one of the process you should really have. So let's have a couple ideas about either these, how you can enunciate these, or other forms of belief. I put in like the interconnectedness of all beings, because that's basically a Buddhist idea. Yeah, I think it's very entrenched in Christianity too. You know, when Paul in Romans says there is no slave or free, there is no man nor woman, there is no Jew or Gentile. I mean, it's very encompassing that, you know, Christianity would accept all in the body of Christ. But that's a classic Buddhist statement. And a Buddhist that's a very nonviolent tradition. And so, are there things there you want to talk about, or would someone be willing to say what, you know, they would, a place you would start from, sitting right here on July 2nd, about a part of what your beliefs is that you think would be, because it could be helpful for everyone to hear. Yeah.
One thing I had sort of been thinking about was, like, as the Lutheran Church is not a peace church, we can't just necessarily say I'm a Lutheran, therefore no war. But thinking about Luther's stress on everyone's call to a certain vocation and how we live our lives should, you know, our call to our vocation is how we should live our lives, and that I don't know how you would prove this necessarily, but that I personally do not feel my vocation is to participate in war.
Right. That's a good argument. Now, let's go a little further. And that's good to tie it into something specific, because that's part of your tradition, you know, Luther. What are the vocations that you have been thinking about or preparing for or think you might be interested in?
And that would be really easy to prove, too, because, I mean, like, when you're in college, you could be like, yeah, well, I'm an English major, and I'm really, you know, interested in writing, and, you know, I want to cultivate that gift that I'm going to use in the world. And that would be such easy proof to maintain, mm-hmm. You know, so.
And if you're an English major and you'd written some things.
Yeah, you could attach them.
This was something from your heart, and you could also just stick down the bottom, put the date, and your computer's probably even got some of those things on it, you know, when you did them. And right away, you can start a file.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bet you anything, Martha, have you written some essays or poetry that would have to do with not only nonviolence, but, you know, where your heart lies on social issues. You know, what you think about, you know, hunger and treatment of the poor and prisoners and all those sort of things which tie in directly into biblical things. Could we, before we go to you, Matt, let me just follow up on this vocation. What vocations, for instance, have you been thinking about?
Well, I'm a political science religion major, and I'm really interested in, like, working for some sort of, like, non-government organization that promotes, Lutheran World Relief or Bread for the World or something like that.
Okay, there's a couple great ideas. If one of the things you can do is show what organizations you belong to or have volunteered with, and the dates on which you started to do those sorts of things. And you could probably substantiate through your curriculum some of the courses that you've been taking that would prove that. And another way he could prove that he's interested in those things are friends or parents. You bring them with you to the local board meeting and have them testify about those kind of interests and when they began and all that sort of thing. That's great. Matt?
I was wondering if you could write a report on your own time. Is that less? And having a look after it.
Yeah, so your question is whether or not you could just write it on your own time, rather than, yeah, that would be fine. It just might be helpful, just like in a situation like this, this first idea, see, you know, Martha gave it another viewpoint and some other people, so it becomes richer. And then like any other written document, you know, editing from somebody, you know, who is a friend and writes well. I've been going to seminary the last couple of years, and my first papers, I practiced a lot for 33 years. My wife would look at him, she's a writer, and she'd say, this is like a lawyer. I said, what do you expect? And now, you know, 3 years later, she said, hey, you can write now. This is getting better. So, you know, I think that helps a lot to have people help you out. But the thoughts always have to be yours.
As I was thinking at, if you're writing it for a last or eight and I something that was actually from her.
Yeah, I think if you wrote something up, I think the way to do that is you can use all of it. You would write up, what's your name, Nick?
Peter.
Peter. If Peter wrote down that his thing about Luther and vocation, and that's important to him, and what his vocation, vocation or plan and vocations were going to be, and then part of it was to substantiate that, he could say, I attach papers that I have written in college in preparing for these kinds of vocations. And that would show the dates, and then so you could just have, you know, exhibit 1, 2, 3, and 4 attached to this answer about belief. Anyone else have an idea besides that vocation idea? It's a very good idea. What you could, or what you would think in terms of your beliefs?
Well, what's going through my head right now is that, like, in Jesus Christ, we all become brothers and sisters, and are obligated to love each other and to show compassion to one another, and that I would not show compassion to one of my brothers and sisters in Christ by participating in the war.
Yeah, I think that's really a powerful one. And with that idea, that's a basic idea, you could go to Matthew and find the part that says, and then you could, I mean, and John is just amazing in its talk about love. And you could make a comment like that, you could quote some of this, and then you could just, I mean, about loving your enemy. I mean, that is a radical thought. Let's see if I can find it here. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, this is Matthew 5:38, do not resist an evildoer. I mean, look at that statement. That is like a classic Buddhist statement out of Jesus' mouth. Non-resistance. Do not resist an evildoer. There are theologians that can't figure out what that means. It may be a wonderful thing to think about and quote. But if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go the second mile. You've heard it said to love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's what it said in the Old Testament. It was a statement that it was important because they needed to maintain the Israelite ethnic identity, but it was exclusive of other traditions and other ethnicities. And Jesus really expanded that tremendously through love and says, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So, I mean, that's just, that thought alone is a sufficient basis for the belief. I mean, it's so encompassing. And it not only includes love and turning the other cheek, but it really ties into this interconnectedness of all beings, just like we were saying before. Anyone have a similar idea or want to comment on that?
Yes, I was thinking of the idea of if you kill someone, and if I were to kill someone, I would feel like I have killed a part of my
Yeah, that's exactly what that teaching means. If we are all brothers and sisters, and we are all children of God, that, I mean, can you imagine killing your brother or your sister? Other than over, you know, some minor thing in the kitchen, like, yo, we wanted to. But I mean, really, kill him.
No.
Well, I think it would be powerful to use examples from Jesus' life too, like especially when Jesus was betrayed and being captured by the Roman soldiers, and one of the disciples cut off the ear of one of the soldiers. And you can say then, and you know, Jesus told him, you know, that was bad, whatever. But you can just say that even in like defense, like war is not like valid at all.
Right.
Like, because even when Jesus was being taken away, right, violence was not an option.
Yeah. And he even said right then, after the thing was cut off, he said, you know, you don't think that I could bring the angels from heaven and handle this whole thing, but that this was not, he wasn't going to use violence. John?
Oh, I was going to say, like all these stories and lines work really well, but like it, I think it's also, I mean, it's good to talk about just who he was in general as the Son of God and like who he was not, you know, and like not a warrior, conqueror, or ruler, like powerful ruler over people, but he was very humble, and his ministry just consisted of walking and living among like the lowest of peoples, and just that whole idea, I think, is
identifying with the marginalized.
Sure.
Yeah.
Dynamite.
And that how
like Jesus was expected to be a warrior, and that when he was alive, the manifestation of God's love that came was not the warrior or the fighter.
You know, what the Israelites wanted him to do is kick the Romans' butt. Okay, let's go down to source now. I think you guys got aces for beliefs. The sources, basically, you need to tie this in to your own, say you can enunciate the belief that it is opposed to participation in all war. Where does it come from? Does it just come from, you know, a magazine you looked up or some resource you had, but or can you tie it into yourself? I just put up a couple things that might, you know, apply for people, and this gets back to your comment. What you can do is you can start a file today. Like, we have one, on our 19-year-old, and it starts from the first time, you know, he started going to the community of St. Martin's, where the vow of nonviolence is an important part of our worship. You know, he was 1 year old. And he took the vow of nonviolence, I think, the first time when he was about 12. And so, you know, and things they'd write at school, stick them in there and have a date on everything.
Right.
You know, keep a file. But let's hear some of the things that, if you resonate with what's been said about belief so far, what has happened in your own life to bring this home, to make it real? Where do you come from? Anyone, including the adults and stuff. Matt?
Board and cheese audio friend of his blew his arms off.
And so you heard descriptions of this real war from the time you were young. That would be good. That would be an excellent support. Anyone else?
Peter.
Have it. Open
your door. I think of Martin Luther King Jr. And history shows that at the same time he was leading his peace marches, that the Black Panthers were participating in violent activities, yet a lot of the communities, because the Black Panthers were feeding the children, were saying were feeling like the Black Panthers were getting the message across a lot better. And at the time, there were a lot of people they couldn't see, especially in the South. They felt like, well, the Black Panthers are feeding us, and our kids are getting fed every day, and it's by this group, not by the peaceful group. But Martin Luther King Jr. had the long range vision to see that by peaceful means, and who does history show us made the advances with civil rights movements, and that's who it was. Mm-hmm. So I think history shows us.
Yeah. And thinking also of Gandhi, perhaps reading about the lives of some of these good role models.
Yep. Yeah. Books.
Sure.
There's another question about that. As far as history, these stories in history supporting what we believe, how is that any different from them saying, like, well, what if we wouldn't have entered World War II? Or going back in history and just completely doing the flip, you know? Like, history has helped to form my personal beliefs, and but it could also just work against me too. So.
Well, it could, but what you're doing, you're testifying that this part of history or these things of history have been significant to you in forming your beliefs. And you can make that distinction. I mean, you can have Gandhi as a hero instead of Patton as a hero. The very fact that there are different kinds doesn't mean in your own particular belief system you can't, you know, claim someone else. It's particularization is to you. Anyone else want to say something about where beliefs would come from?
Well, and I think also if you were to take some of these instances like Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, or even the fall of apartheid in South Africa and look at it, what would have happened had this been same result had been tried in a violent means?
Mm-hmm.
Think of all the, you know, the horror that, and violence just adds more violence. But by doing it peacefully, yes, people die, but nowhere near the number.
Yep. Violence breeds more violence. Okay, and sincerity, here, go down just a little bit further. These are some of the things we've already talked about, actually. You know, keeping some articles. If you've done a crop walk, you know, to start indicating, you know, when those sort of things, because then you can build on that. That can be one of the events. Well, you know, why did you do a crop walk? I mean, what was the basis of it, you know? And at what age did you start doing that? So if you can just start keeping a diary, like of community service activities, those sorts of things, if some significant things happened, and it was reported in the newspaper, not about you even, but a significant thing happened in your community or in the world or in the nation that solidified more your belief in opposing war. Just stick a copy of the article in it. And then it does a couple things. It sets a date and it gives you something else, you know, you can mention in your answer. We talked about prayers in school, faith practices. And then you can bring witnesses in that relate to these different things, you know, from your family or your minister at church that could testify as to those things. When you keep a file, it is advantageous, like if you have correspondence with the Selective Service System, always keep a copy of everything. In other words, you know, we're used to just sending off letters and waiting for the response, blah, blah, blah. It's just like you're getting ready, you know, to prove something. So every time you write a letter, like one thing you could do is recommended by some of these centers, and I have a couple addresses and websites up here for you if you're interested. We just pass these around and people could, you know, jot them down. One is in Minneapolis. Women Against Military Madness, and for $3 they will send you this book that's got everything, all sorts of things in it that we've just talked about, and ideas and what have you. And the other, I think, is the Center for Conscientious Objection, which has prepared a lot of the materials there. I just know the people at WAM because I've represented them in different things, and I said if people, you know, write to them, would you send them a packet? They said, yeah, just have them send $3.
I believe Lutheran Peace Fellowship and Fellowship of Reconciliation have a similar.
FOR is fantastic, yeah. And you can, you know, get, you know, do links on the internet and find a lot of these organizations. In registration, if you're not 18 yet, you can register online, but what these organizations are recommending, if you think you're going to claim conscientious objection or you want to start making, you can download, and so you get the form to mail in, and although the form doesn't have anything on it, because there is no deferment process right now, you can write, I am a conscientious objector. But if you mail that in, they won't ever have a record of it because they just take the information off the form. In fact, they don't want to have a record of it, and they throw the form away and they just input it in the computer. So you have to keep a copy of that.
How young can you do that?
I have a 14-year-old.
When the kid's 18.
Okay.
I think it's just men now, because there is no draft. You have a son?
Yeah.
Yeah, within, I don't know, what is it, 30 days, John? You had to register. Mm-hmm. 30 days of your 18th birthday? Oh. Some people don't register.
Everyone registers?
Everyone in the all men in the country register. And if some people who have really thought about it and are organized refuse to register as an act of resistance, that in itself can be a crime, and the other, which refusing induction can be a crime. You know, if they disagree with your deferment process, I haven't had time to go through all the steps, you know, that it takes for appeals and legal process and everything, but, you know, if it, I had a guy, I was giving this presentation at St. Mark's in Minneapolis, and I got all through how to do this, and one guy raised his hand in the back, he had a big old gray beard, and three-piece suit on. He said, I did everything you said. He said, I was out in Wilmer, Minnesota, and I walked into the draft board, and after I gave my whole presentation, one of the guys on the draft board said, are you Catholic? And I said, yes. And he says, ha, I gotcha, the Crusades. And so they turned him down. And so, you know, to make the point then, if there's disagreement, and oftentimes there is, because they have an agenda, you know, they want to get people into the service, you might have to go to court. And during most of the war, if you would lose your court case, you'd get 6 months in Minnesota, in federal prison. Toward the end, there was so much public outcry against the war and the draft that the judges didn't send anyone to prison anymore. They ordered them all to do alternative service as if the local board would have granted the application in the first place. But you need to think about those things, but that's a very good place to start if you decide to register and you've thought about this and you don't want to participate in a war and killing. To write right across the front of the registration, put a copy in the file, I'm a conscientious objector. And if you start that file, then that's going to spur people on to start gathering this evidence. And so it's very helpful for the parents to be supportive, obviously. So it's great that some parents are here, but basically it comes down to you, you know, 18 to 26 year olds, to make the case. I mean, your dad can be a CO, and that doesn't qualify you. So you have to be able to articulate your beliefs, and they have to be sincerely held. And so it probably would be wise to, even when you go back next fall, start college, write about conscientious objection on your first paper where you can choose the topic. Be good practice.
If we're over 18 and we've already registered and obviously not put down on the card anything, is it worth it to, like, sort of retroactively, like, send a letter down to the Selective Service and say, I know I don't have to say this, but I just want to put it out there, or is that
would
just cause more?
I would. Yep. Would. It can't hurt you at all. They might just throw it away, but you can save a copy of the letter. And if it gets down to some really crucial things on your application, send everything. Don't always expect the government's going to make a form that's going to help you out. They don't do that kind of thing. Send letters and always send a certified receipt requested, so you've got a guy's signature, the draft board who got it, and you have the proof that you mailed it. So they can't say, well, you probably just made this up later on. You want a chronology of proof. So that's a great point, and if you feel that way, you should go home and write that out right now. Or just take the registration form again and say, you know, since Right on it. You know, since I registered, I've been informed that I could have declared conscientious objection, which I didn't know at the time. I am a conscientious objector. And just re-register. Nothing will happen, and you will have a record. And for women, it's a little trickier. You just have to start, you know, you're not going to have any impact with them right now unless they institute a new draft. Because you don't have to register, but if there is a new draft, I'm very certain it'll be include all big genders. I mean, in Vietnam, you know, there are almost no women in the army, volunteers, and they're, but now it's totally changed.
Peter, do you have any time to address the non-combatant status?
That would probably be good. Why don't we just take that one question and then break? Let me do it this way. How would any of you feel about being the mechanic on the plane that dropped a bomb? So you wouldn't be pulling the trigger, you wouldn't see the blood, you wouldn't even be opening the hatch to let the bombs come out, you'd be on the ground turning a wrench. That would be the kind of thing you could get non-combatant status if you were a CO in the military. See, some people go into the military and then they realize, oh man, what did I ever do this for? And they can't get out, so they apply for CO status within the military and then they get a non-combatant job. So how would you, that's helpful to think about that. Let's discuss it for 60 seconds because, you know, if you're going to make the claim, you have to make the choice whether or not you're going to be only seek combatant exemption or combatant and non-combatant exemption. Basically, if you're in the Army, you know, you do your service in the Army, and if you're not in the Army, if you seek exemption of both, then you get alternative service from the board and you work at some job as a CO for 2 years. We had a guy here when I was living here, he was 80 years old, he was a Quaker, a physician. He'd been a CO in both World War I and World War II. And he said he got beat up a lot of times and all sorts of stuff. And he said they put him on the most dangerous things they could find. He was a fire jumper on forced fires on Agnes Creek over here. And they, you know, pushed him out of the airplane with nothing but a shovel out into a mountainous region to go fight fires. So it was fair. It was a lot more dangerous than being in the military back then. But you would get something if you were in the local board and you got CO status. You know, they'd have you work in at a hospital or for Goodwill Industries or some social service organization. So how would you feel about turning the wrench on the plane, Adrian?
I think it would still, in my eyes, be supporting the war, obviously, because you're using your skills to, yeah, support the war. But I think it would definitely be better than, you know, being on the front line. So I think I do have a question, though. It's kind of not, well, it's kind of relating. What happens to you if you were to just like pick up and go to Canada? Do they come and search for you, or you would just like never come back? Or what's the deal with that? Like, if you get denied and you just leave?
What you need to look into is if Canada is going to accept you as they did back during Vietnam. I understand that's changing. Anyone else know about that more than I do? You guys are shaking your heads. But
I just heard that it's different from being across the line.
And so they might, Canada might not accept you, or if you're there just to evade the draft, they may deport you back and, you know, things would probably go.
Basically, you have to do the same thing that you do here. You have to prove that you're immigrating not to escape this particular war. So it's...
How about if you're immigrating to escape living in a country that's gone insane and you don't know anything about the politics?
Political asylum?
Not political asylum. You just want to go to a country that, you know, is socialized medicine and they don't go around attacking people and...
You can say that, but if it's in the middle of a draft and you're draftable, you'll probably have to address that point.
So you think if Adrienne went now, she'd be better off than if the draft had already begun?
Yes, definitely.
I have some friends that were trying to go like 6 months ago, and they weren't accepted. They didn't make it good enough. Like, I guess just being opposed to the war and opposed to like some of the government decisions now is not good enough anymore.
Could everyone hear that?
Yeah.
Thanks. So, it's a sticky wicket. But the one thing, I just want to do one little when you said it would be better than going on the front line,
mm-hmm.
that would, they could turn that around and say, that is not good faith. That is just trying to avoid a consequence.
Well, yeah, I don't think I would say that.
Well, I mean, it's just good practice. It's just good practice, and that's why it's helpful to have an editor. I know you didn't mean to say it, and that's a very honest statement, but you just need to keep it with, I would do nothing to support the overall war effort.
That's what's so difficult, though, is because, like, if, you know, you're turning screws or whatever on the plane, like, you're still contributing to the effort very physically, and just, like, it's one level more indirect, or less direct than, like, actually throwing a bomb or whatever. But then if you... like, can project that, like, just, like, living in America during wartime, like, you know, having a job, you know, you're supporting that economy in some way that is contributing to the war effort, or, you know, yeah, paying taxes. I mean, how can you really escape contributing to it in some way unless you move out or establish some extensive barter system? Like, I don't know, like, how?
Well, there's, yeah, and any of those things, see, they have, there is... all the military complex, you know, wants to avoid any of those things. And so if you do war tax resistance, you know, you can get prosecuted by the IRS. And there's not necessarily an easy way out of this. And matters of conscience oftentimes don't give you easy way out. But I'll bet you anything, the guys who did 6 months back in Vietnam at a federal prison camp were a lot less psychologically scarred than the people that went to Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
So that's your choice if they don't accept
if everything goes bad.
Then, and you say, I'm still not going to go, you just go to prison?
Yep.
I think when you're talking about the non-combatant thing, to prove that you wouldn't want to do that, it seems like it'd be harder to do. And part of it would be, some people would be like, well, I'm just turning a crank and it has nothing to do with putting me in danger or killing someone else. But I think it would help to prove that you have beliefs behind things that you do in your everyday life, like you won't shop at Walmart because they support sweatshops. Mm-hmm. And that's not, some people would see it just as, I'm buying your shoes at Walmart, you know, but you have to show that you have beliefs behind the not so obvious action.
It's maybe more subtle, but it shows a more consistent life. That's a great point. One more comment, we better get ready for Vespers.
I have one question about, like, one place I assume they would might assign you if you were a non-combatant CO would be in a hospital as, like, a medic. And, I would feel caught if they asked me how I would feel about being a medic during a war, because my problem would be is, like, they're bringing in people. Am I supposed to just stand there and not do anything because I'm against why they're hurt? I mean, I feel like I believe more in my belief in, like, the sanctity of life would override my opposition to why they had been hurt in order to treat them. And how would that, like, how would that work in an application as a CEO?
Well, that's a personal choice. I mean, you just have to decide whether or not, you don't, first of all, you wouldn't know what you'd get assigned to,
right,
unless you're a physician.
Right.
Or a nurse.
Or a nurse, then you'd know you'd probably get assigned to medical. But it is, I mean, the difference, I guess, is that without the doctors and the nurses, even though they're doing wonderful humanitarian work, you know, they couldn't continue to prosecute the war. So you would be a part, even though an indirect part, just like the guy who's turning the bolt with the wrench. It's a totally, it's your choice. One thing about being a CO in the military, it's hell. You can imagine all these other people are, you know, seeing their buddies die, and, you know, they know what a CO is. It's a chicken.
And it's not like the world that we live in. It's like they have their own rules and their own ways of taking care of it, and they turn their head to a lot of it. It goes on. The hazing that happens on some of these college campuses is nothing like what happens in the military.
So if you say that you object to war on the ground that like violence isn't a suitable way of solving problems, would they ever ask you like what you think a better way is?
They could.
I mean, is that...
But all of those kinds of questions...
I mean, how would you go about answering that? Because, I mean...
Well...
You don't know a way. Like, I don't know...
If they ask me that question, I'd say, well, I think that's, you know, not really about the fact that I am opposed to participation in war. But I'm glad to try and answer your question. Then I would say, you know, a better way to combat with conflict is through nonviolent resolution, like the Nonviolent Peace Force. And I would be willing to go as a peacekeeper to an area of conflict and try and create some space through monitoring and presence and things like that, rather than use of guns, because I think violence ultimately only creates more violence. But so that would be a nice way to answer the question without saying, hey, dummy, that doesn't have anything to do with it, whether I am conscientiously opposed to all war, which it doesn't. So all the kind of trick questions like, you know, if your brother was standing there and someone was going to kill him and you could kill the guy who killed him before he was shot, you know, would you pull the trigger? That has nothing to do with, you know, whether or not. You don't have to be a pacifist to be a CO. And that, I would argue, is not a test of pacifism. You know, that's an extreme hypothetical situation. And I believe at this point in my life, I'm a pacifist. And if someone was going to do that to my son, I would stop him any way I could, as fast as I could. And it wouldn't disqualify me from having a well-founded belief in nonviolence. It's just, if you have no other alternative, you have no other alternative. But those are the kind of questions that they don't really have anything to do with whether or not you have a conscientious objection to participation in a particular war in your life. Okay. Thank you very much. And you can take copies of any of these things that I had up here. And if you want to talk to me, I'm going to be here for about 10 more days about specifics in your own situation. I'd be glad to talk with you. Take a picture of that bag and put down the date.